Welcome to this Wednesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. It's the beginning of our short and sweet fun drive. I'm Craig Blumenschein. A little bit later, we'll encourage you to take advantage of our short and sweet fun drive. We want to send you some incredibly great tasting chocolate truffles in time for Valentine's Day and your special one from Nicole's Fine Pastries. There'll be more on that in just a minute. And also a little bit later today, Rick Guillon joins us for another edition of Prairie Plates.
But first, Dr. Clint Boyd joins us. Dr. Boyd holds an advanced degree from the University of Texas. He is North Dakota's senior paleontologist and leads the paleontology program for the North Dakota Geological Survey, and he also curates North Dakota's state fossil collection. Dr. Boyd's expertise ensures the preservation and exploration of the state's rich fossil history. Dr. Boyd, welcome to Main Street.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
We are very, very pleased that you're here. We have a lot to talk about with you today. I want to begin with a discovery of sorts that's been going on for a few years underneath a garage in North Dakota, the site of potentially mammoth remains. I would like you to bring us up to date on that and also maybe start with the history of how it was discovered and what's happened since.
Sure. It is a long-running project. It was first discovered all the way back in 1988. When they were adding an attached garage to an existing house and a property in western North Dakota. And the individuals doing the construction work as they were digging the foundation for the garage ran into some large bones that were unearthed out of the ground. And at that time, they showed it to the landowner, and the landowner was not that interested in the discovery. And since it was private land, fossils on private land belonged to the private landowner. And so he had them just pile the bones that had been unearthed back up against the foundation when they went to backfill at the end of the project and left it alone. And at that time, word did get out to the Geological Survey, who I work for now, and one of the geologists went out to check on the site, but by the time he got there, everything had already been backfilled and covered over. But he kept that in his mind through the years, and he is now the state geologist, Ed Murphy. And last year, he decided to check up on the property and see if it was still the same landowner and if anything had ever happened with that specimen. And it turned out there was a different landowner now. And this new landowner was very open to the idea of exploring to see if these rumors about there being a mammoth skeleton were true or not. And so that's when our most recent project picked up on this earlier this year. So in May, we went out along with archaeologists from the State Historical Society that brought a ground-penetrating radar setup that allows us to shoot radar down into the ground and then get reflections back and look for large buried objects underground. And usually this is used to find, like buried foundations and things like that that are very different from the surrounding material. It doesn't get used a lot for fossils, but in this case, we were looking for a very large animal, a mammoth, and we were hoping that some of the larger bones would be big enough that they might show up on this ground-penetrating radar. And so ran grids around the garage on all sides and got some interesting returns from the ground-penetrating radar. And between that and getting back in touch with some of the individuals that had done the original construction work and getting their stories on where material should be at underground, we did a quick test pit in May and did uncover a couple of bones that looked to be from mammoth down at about the level that we would expect them to be at. And so we have our public fossil digs we run every summer. So we had to pause for June through August and take care of that work. But we returned then in September and opened up a large scale pit, ended up being about 2 meters by 4 meters that we opened up north of the garage and dug down. And we've uncovered several dozen partial bones so far that came out, and a few of them isolated, were able to just take right out of the ground. And then there were 10 plaster protective jackets that we formed as well to take out some of the more fragile material. And there's still more to go at the site, but that's as much as we could get done this fall before we had to move on to other things. But so far, everything that we're being told by the original construction crew in terms of what bones they thought they found and where it should be all matches up really well. But unfortunately, that means that in their story, most of the specimen is under the slab that was laid for the main garage, which means that much of this animal is probably directly underneath the existing garage.
And your ground penetrating radar can't quite see underneath that cement. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So if it had just been like poured cement with nothing else in it, we might have the ability to get through it with the ground penetrating radar. But because it has both rebar and some metal mesh that's inside to give it strength, which is pretty typical. All that metal reflects the signal back almost immediately, and we don't get enough signal through to see what's underneath.
So Dr. Boyd, give me some context about what a mammoth is. I was surprised that they've been in North Dakota relatively recently.
Yeah, so they persisted in North America and into North Dakota up until about 10,000 years ago. It varies a little bit, when you get the last occurrences, but about 10,000 years ago is the last occurrence. This specific specimen, we've sent a piece of bone out and got an age back of about 13,500 years on it. So it's on the younger side for a mammoth, but they're here right up to the end of the last ice age, which is about 10,000 years ago.
And a mammoth is about the size of an elephant. Is that an accurate description?
They're a little bit bigger than most modern elephants. They're a little taller at the shoulder, a little more upright in stance, but they're very large animals. Yeah.
So what happens next? How do you continue the project?
So there's kind of two phases as we look ahead at what to keep doing at the site. The first is to continue what we're already doing, which is to work in a very organized, very methodical, meter by meter grid outside of the garage, collecting all of the bones that are in place in the ground outside. And so, like I said, we did that for 2 meters by 8 meters, so 8 grids that we've cleared out so far. But the bones have continued a little bit further to the north. And so we do need to keep doing some of that work to make sure we get absolutely everything that's outside the garage. But then the second phase is eventually, if we want to recover all the specimen, we need to cut through the slab in the garage and actually get underneath the slab there and hopefully find what is the main concentration of bones there.
Is this a rare find for North Dakota?
So we do get isolated bones from mammoths, not that uncommonly in North Dakota. Find an isolated tooth here, a bit of bone there, a piece of tusk there. Specimens that are like partial skeletons where you've got quite a bit of an animal there are not very common in North Dakota for whatever reason. We just haven't had much luck in finding them. We did collect a partial specimen that had about 20 bones preserved out of the Freedom Mine in Beulah, North Dakota last year, including a really beautiful 7-foot long tusk. But this specimen could potentially be even more complete than that if it does continue underneath the slab. The other thing that's interesting about this specimen is as we've been cleaning up the bones, it turns out that it's from a juvenile, a not fully grown individual. That we have even less of in our collections is juvenile material. So it would be even more interesting to get this specimen out and see exactly how old it was, maybe how it died, and anything else that it can tell us about that time period.
There were local students assisting already with this dig?
Yeah, so when we first went out in May, the local school brought the school kids out, class at a time, kindergarten and first grade, second grade. And throughout the day as we were working, the first classes would show up, and we had just finished the ground penetrating radar. We were just starting to dig our first test pit. And so since we had to get down, the bones are about 30 inches below the ground. We had some of the students assist us in removing some of that overlying rock to get that, or overlying soil, it's not really rock, to get down closer to the specimen. And then as the day would go on, like an older class would come and we're a little bit further down. And by the end of the day, we managed to expose those first couple bones. And so that class then, when they returned back to the school, got to the school and told everybody else, like, hey, they've actually found bones. And there was a big cheer that, that we'd found stuff there and we were being successful. And then when we went back in September, the same school brought several of the classes out again so that they could see kind of the progression of work at the site. They were there when we first started a test pit. Now we had this big excavation open with several bones exposed, and they could see how that's progressed so far. So it's been a good, I think, interactive experience for the local school kids.
Your publications that you've written cover diverse topics, really, from mammoth fossils to dinosaur anatomy. What interests you the most about what you do day in and day out, Dr. Boyd?
Paleontologists can be broken down in a few different ways based on what they study. There's people who focus on like specific animals. So they say like, I really like, say, this type of meat-eating dinosaur, and most of my research is going to be on this one species. And then there's other ones that say like, well, if there's a specific kind of general field that I like, you know, say that it's like studying past environments or something like that and learning about how the environment has changed over time, and that's what they focus on. And in my position here working for the State Geological Survey, my work has to be confined within the state because that's who I work for. And so I follow what I call more of a question-based research program, which is I want to find unanswered questions about fossils or prehistoric environments in North Dakota. And when we get good pieces of evidence about that, I want to follow up on it. And so, like you said, my publications tend to be rather diverse in scope because, you know, there's a wide range of ages and different types of animals that we find here in North Dakota. And as long as there is an interesting question to be asked about those fossils that's important to study, that's what I want to do. And so my research does tend to be kind of, you know, all over the place with that kind of stuff, but it keeps it fresh. You know, you never know what you're going to be doing from year to year and what you're going to find when you go out.
We're enjoying our conversation with Dr. Clint Boyd. He earned his PhD in geosciences from the University of Texas at Austin in 2012, and he manages the paleontology program for the North Dakota Geological Survey and serves as curator of the North Dakota State Fossil Collection. What's the coolest fossil in the North Dakota State Fossil Collection, Dr. Boyd?
That pretty definitively is our Dakota the Dinosaur Mummy, which is a fossilized specimen of the duck-billed dinosaur Edmontosaurus from the very end of the age of dinosaurs. And it is very well preserved. We have most of the skeleton, and it's so well preserved that we even have the actual skin preserved over most of the specimen. Not like an imprint of the skin, but the actual three-dimensional skin preserved. So that's kind of our crown jewel of the North Dakota State Fossil Collection.
Where can people see the collection?
So our collection is stored in the North Dakota State Museum and Heritage Center on the Capitol grounds in Bismarck. But we do have 26 different exhibits across the state in different small museums and visitor centers all over. So our main exhibit is here in Bismarck, but we do have little exhibits all across the state if people are interested in seeing some of the stuff that we found.
What's the most exciting or impactful fossil discovery that you've worked on during your time in your current role?
Well, I am doing some research on our dinosaur mummy that I mentioned. That's been very interesting for me. Otherwise, we're doing a lot of research right now on fossil crocodiles from North Dakota from just before the end Cretaceous extinction and just afterwards. And so looking at how does our crocodile fauna change from before the extinction event to after the extinction event here in North Dakota. I mean, that's actually turning up some pretty interesting results and what's probably going to be several new species of smaller crocodiles. So everyone likes to think of the giant like dinosaur hunting size crocodiles in the Cretaceous, but there was quite a diversity of kind of dwarfed smaller species of crocodilians at this time that have kind of been ignored just because they weren't big and flashy. And we're getting a very good record of those critters. And so over the next few years, we'll be publishing on some of those. I think people will find quite interesting.
Dr. Boyd, I hail from Wyoming, and everybody can name one of Wyoming's national monuments, and that is Devil's Tower. But they struggle to name the second one, and that's Fossil Butte National Monument. Does mm-hmm. North Dakota have a place that's similar in makeup to Wyoming's Fossil Butte National Monument, where there are literally just fossils everywhere?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to match Fossil Butte. That's just an amazing place. We do have a deposit that is similar in preservation in North Dakota, which is just outside the town of Sentinel Butte, North Dakota, in the western edge, where there is a preserved pond deposit up on top of Sentinel Butte that has similarly preserved fish fossils to what you find at Fossil Butte. They're a little bit younger in age than the ones that are at Fossil Butte. And unfortunately, nowadays, it was a very popular place when it was first discovered for people to collect these little beautiful sunfishes, is what most of them are at that site. And now there's not really any more exposed. There's probably more of the layer there, but it's buried underneath the ground. You'd have to dig way back in to get it. But the fossils that we have from there, we've got a pretty good collection of them. And they're just beautifully preserved fish, you know, in that nice kind of flat panel view that you typically think of for those fish from Fossil Butte. So we do have some fish like that. Otherwise, in terms of just like abundance of fossils coming out, we do have some outcrops of what's called the White River Group, which is a Oligocene in age, about 32 million years old. Most of those are just south of the town of Dickinson, although there's some down by the town of Amadon as well in the very southwest corner of the state. Those are mostly mammal fossils that we get in those sites and very productive beds from there. People don't get quite as excited when we want to go out there and they're like, well, what are you going to look for? Are you looking for dinosaurs? We're like, no, we're looking for mammals. In fact, there's a lot of like fossil mice from here. And then we get fossil mice, like, okay, whatever. Like, well, but they are fun. They're interesting. And, you know, they tell us a lot about the environment back then. I do have a soft spot for them.
I want to talk to you about the challenges in your work. You must assume that funding and fiscal support is one of them. You'd probably like to do much, much more, but have to prioritize what you can do.
Yeah, I mean, that's the case for everybody. You know, there's always more that you would like to do with more funding. But we do, I would say, get very good support from the state of North Dakota for our program. In general, I found that, you know, North Dakotans are very interested in paleontology, and we've had very good support for all the projects that we've been doing, including our public fossil digs that we run every summer, 43 days of those. There's always more that you could be doing, but we have a pretty good program here. And in fact, we're one of the largest, if not the largest, paleontology programs at a state geological survey in the country. So I think that we have to be especially thankful for.
Do you teach as well, Dr. Boyd, in your current role?
I do not. We do have some affiliation with both University of North Dakota and North Dakota State as far as collaborating on research. And in fact, the Geological Survey used to be a part of the geology department at the University of North Dakota originally, but that was changed in the 80s. And so at this point, we don't do any college level teaching, although as part of our public fossil digs, we do offer a continuing education course for teachers that they can take and come out with us. There's a day in the classroom here in our collections, and then a day out in the field with us to learn more about paleontology and how to adapt those concepts for their classroom.
Speaking of classroom, would you give advice to kids that this is a great field to pursue a career in?
I might be a little biased. I think it's a wonderful career to follow into. It does take, you know, some persistence. There's a lot of training and education that you have to go through to get to the point where you can do it as a full-time occupation. There's a bit of competition as well because it is a very flashy, interesting field. But what I like about it is that going to work every day doesn't really feel like work because there's always fun things that we're doing. There's new things that we're discovering. Every time we go do field work, you know, you're finding fossils that no one, even if it's a species that we've seen before, that specific fossil has never been seen before by human eyes when it gets discovered. And that never gets old for me. And there's really nothing that can take the place of that in my view. And so people that feel that way, you know, I think all of the effort and challenges are worth it to get to the point where you can enjoy that every day.
Is it hard for you to balance the work that you want to do with the public outreach and education that you also do in your job?
It can be a bit. And I think the most successful way to do that is what we try to do, which is to try to blend our outreach activities with the research activities so that they're not entirely separate activities that we're doing. So it's not like, well, either we do our research stuff or we do these educational programs. You know, for our public fossil digs, we take the participants to our research sites. We're not just taking them to like some random place where like, oh, we can maybe find some fossils here, but you know, they're not super important fossils. So, you know, if something happens to them, it doesn't matter. It's like, no, we take them to our research sites and have them help us collect the important specimens that we're going to work on. And so by combining those two things up, it doesn't become an either or, it becomes a, how do we layer these things together in a way that makes all of the things that we need to get done work together synergistically and reach a positive conclusion.
I'm Craig Blumenschein for Main Street. We're going to have more of our interview with Dr. Boyd here in just a bit, but we want to continue our short and sweet pledge drive, radio pledge drive. In the Main Street studio with me is my friend Rick Gion. Rick, how are you?
I'm doing well, Craig. It's good to be with you today on this Pledge Drive day, and it's the beginning of our Short and Sweet Pledge Drive, which goes through Saturday.
This is a wonderful, my favorite Pledge Drive that we do,
yes,
because we can send a really good tasting box of cocoa truffles to our loved ones. It might be our parents, it might be our partners, it might be our kids, but it also supports Prairie Public, and that's why we're here to ask you, our listeners, to support Prairie Public.
And you can also get some yourself, so don't forget about that. Selfish
That's
gifts.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, for $15 a month as a sustaining member or more, you can get a box of 9 handcrafted cocoa truffles from Nicole's Fine Pastry. Nicole's is a James Beard semi-finalist bakery. They got that award last year, and so you can trust they're going to be really, really good.
One box of truffles, as Rick said, $15 a month. If you would like to have 2 boxes sent to 2 different places, a $20 a month sustaining donation is what we ask. 3 boxes, $25 a month. 4 boxes, it gets better and better, $30 a month. And 5 boxes, a $35 a month sustaining donation. We are hoping, Rick, our goal is 500 boxes, to ship 500 boxes here in Fargo,
wow,
across North Dakota, across the country, and we promise we will do everything that we possibly can to get those delicious chocolate truffles to whoever you'd like us to send them to with a handwritten note before Valentine's Day. And Rick, I want to add one more thing, and I'll give it back to you. Every donor is also entered into a giveaway for a 2-night stay at the Hotel Donaldson in downtown Fargo and a $100 gift card to the Blarney Stone at the Hotel Donaldson.
And that's really good, because there is really good food at the Blarney Stone. I'm telling you, you can get bangers and mash, corned beef and cabbage, fish and chips, Irish stew, some of those traditional Irish pub items. And also they have really good burgers, wraps, soups. So get entered today.
We hope that you support programs like Main Street. That's why we are here, Rick and I,
yeah,
asking you to support Prairie Public. Whether you like the news that we offer, the music that we offer, we hope that this is a good time for you to support Prairie Public. Rick has a couple people to thank, and then we're going to toss it to our news department here.
Susan in Hettinger County from New England, North Dakota, where a lot of my family's from, by the Rainy Buttes, and we were talking about fossils. A lot of fossils out there in that area close to Amadon. But Susan says, had some very nice things to say about Prairie Public. She said, "I cannot tell you enough how much this station has kept me informed."
That's so nice to hear.
"And entertained."
We'll be back with more of Dr. Boyd, but first, this.
Main Street continues here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we resume our conversation with North Dakota's senior paleontologist, Clint Boyd. I asked Dr. Boyd what his goals are in the upcoming year.
So one big thing that we've been working on is getting better ages on all of the rocks exposed on the surface of North Dakota, and doing that through studying the fossils that are there. And so just doing very, very detailed, like down to like collecting every few centimeters from these rocks and recovering the specific fossils that are there, and then using that to correlate to other areas. That's a big project that we have, so that we have a really kind of precise understanding of when different rocks are being deposited in North Dakota, when different environments are here in North Dakota, so we can better understand North Dakota's past. But we also have, you know, broader goals of bringing our program even more into the forefront for the public to see. And so, like right now, we have our public fossil dig program where people can come out and dig with us. And we want to supplement that with a viewable fossil prep lab here at the State Museum in Bismarck in the gallery upstairs. Because right now, all of our cleaning and stabilizing of fossils happens downstairs in the staff area. And what we'd like to get is what some museums have, which is a public fossil prep lab up where people can watch all of that work happen. That way, if they join us on the public fossil digs, they can see fossils being discovered and removed from the ground. They could come into the museum and they can see fossils being taken out of those field jackets and cleaned up and stabilized, and then see the end result in the exhibits of those fully cleaned and stabilized fossils that we found from North Dakota. And so then every step of what we do is in public view for people to understand how these fossils are being found and how we learn from them. And so it's not an opaque process of just being given information from scientists. It's a process where they can see every bit of what's going on. And so that's another big goal that we have.
Complete this sentence as we leave today, Dr. Boyd. It would be the biggest surprise to people from North Dakota that what has lived here in the past?
Oh boy. One thing that when we give tours of our collections and show people stuff that I think people find the most interesting is those rocks that I mentioned south of Dickinson from the White River Group, about 32 million years old. One of the main animals that we find there is an animal called Subhyracodon, which is an extinct rhinoceros. And I think a lot of North Dakotans are surprised to learn that we used to have rhinoceros in North America. And in fact, rhinos first evolved in North America before spreading elsewhere and then going extinct here. And so showing them these like very large rhino skulls that we get out of there, just beautifully preserved, I think adds another layer for people. People think about dinosaurs, right? You know, and then they expect like, oh yeah, there was these things like dinosaurs that are completely extinct now that used to be here. But to show them an animal that, you know, fits with our modern world, like we can imagine what a rhinoceros is, but we can't really imagine one here in North Dakota, but they were here originally. And without the fossil record, you know, we would never know that. And so I think that's one of the things that people find most interesting.
Dr. Clint Boyd manages the paleontology program for the North Dakota Geological Survey and serves as the curator of the North Dakota State Fossil Collection. And he's been my guest today on Main Street. Dr. Boyd, best wishes with the mammal work that you're pursuing and best wishes also with the rest of your tasks. Thanks so much for joining us on Main Street.
Happy to be here.
I'm Craig Blumenschein, and this is Main Street. We're live in the Main Street studio. My good friend Rick Gian is here because we're going to toss up an edition of Prairie Plates here in just a minute, Rick. And we've got a great one. But before we throw it over to you, Rick, I want to encourage folks to call us right now at 800-359-4145 or to go online to prairiepublic.org to show your support for Prairie Public, to show your support for people you love, to show your support for Valentine's Day, and to show your support that you love chocolate, Rick.
Yes, that's, again, 800-359-4145 or prairiepublic.org. $15 a month gets you a box of handmade gourmet cocoa truffles from Nicole's Fine Pastry in downtown Fargo. What could be better than that, Craig?
To get a box for Valentine's Day, you can send them to someone here in North Dakota.
You can.
You can send them somewhere to somebody in my native state, to Wyoming.
Yes.
Or anywhere in the country. We'll box them up and we'll get them out to your loved one in time for Valentine's Day. But the bottom line, you can now support Prairie Public by participating in this short and sweet pledge drive. That's why we're here today. Nicole's Fine Pastry has been a wonderful supporter of Prairie Public for a long, long time. We are deeply thankful that she chooses to do that. But we're asking you to support us too with your dollars. Again, $15 a month gets you a box of truffles shipped wherever you would like. And as Rick said earlier, maybe even to yourself. I don't know, but it's in time for Valentine's Day, so it works.
Or you can send them to my apartment. I'd be happy to give that out off the air. But not only can you get some really, really good chocolates, you'll be entered into a two-night stay prize at the Hotel Donaldson in downtown Fargo and a $100 gift card to the Blarney Stone at the Hotel Donaldson. So really, really a fun prize package we're giving away for this short and sweet drive.
So what does your support bring to us here at Prairie Public? Well, it brings us shows like Main Street, interviews like we just had with Dr. Boyd. Who knew that rhinos were here in North Dakota? I mean, I didn't. And it's guests like that. Tomorrow we're going to talk about how rangeland can manage carbon in our atmosphere because of some great science that's happening right here in North Dakota. Not elsewhere. We wouldn't get these stories, Rick, if we were a national program hearing it from Illinois or from, I don't know, the West Coast or wherever. So we do stories about North Dakota. That's what we like to bring to our listeners. And that's why we need their support during this short and sweet pledge drive. You have some folks that have also called in already.
Yeah, speaking of a listener that's a good supporter, Becky in Bismarck And she wrote in saying, keep doing what you're doing, providing reliable news, up-to-date information, and heartwarming stories and more. We love hearing stories like that. We'll read them on the air. So thanks for calling in and showing your support today.
This is an important time for us here at Prairie Public. It's everyone, I think, might understand that, and that's why we're making the ask. We do it each and every year, Rick, but we want folks to support Prairie Public in this short and sweet pledge drive. But now, Rick, we're going to talk some food, and boy, do we have a good prairie plate to serve up.
Yeah, Jada Cody from Louisiana, who was a hot dish judge with me on Sunday.
I like bagels.
Have some salad.
All I eat is pizza.
Eat some barbecue.
Applesauce and some nice red beets.
There's the music we hear every Wednesday here on Main Street. It's time for Prairie Plates with Rick Guillon. Rick, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back, Craig. There's a lot to talk about today, a lot to dish about.
A lot to dish about today. And okay, now, do you have North Dakota or South Dakota as your guest today? We got to figure that out.
You can ask him about that.
Jay Dakota is our guest. Jay is well-known in Food Network arenas, and Jay was here to help visit and judge, I think, in the Hot Dish Festival. Jay, welcome to Main Street and to Prairie Plates.
Thank you, Craig. Appreciate you having me.
So you were called South Dakota as a kid. Is that right?
Yeah, well, the last name is Dakota. It's actually Cajun French, but I had my older brother is a year and a half older than me, and so North Dakota and South Dakota was kind of a joke growing up because the last name is pretty similar to Dakota.
You've been on College Game Day twice, so my first non-food question for you has to be, how cool is Kirk Herbstreit?
Kirk's really cool, man. Yeah, I was a featured chef on ESPN College Game Day in 2018 and 2019 as it came through LSU, and I got to cook for the gang up there. The first year I did a big Louisiana seafood feast and brought that up to Kirk Herbstreit and Lee Corso and everybody. Kirk was awesome, really cool guy. I mean, it's a really quick segment. You know, you got a minute to bring the food up there, watch them take a couple bites, they go to commercial, and you got to clear out. But the second year, John Goodman was the guest picker.
Nice.
And they actually had me, it was the LSU Florida game, and they had me roasting a whole alligator on a spit right next to the game day set, basically. And then they filmed a segment with John Goodman over there hanging out with me and the alligator. So that was pretty fun.
Rick, I'm not sure we're going to see a alligator being roasted on a spit in Broadway Square here in Fargo. But Jay did join you at the Hot Dish Festival held at Brujala over the weekend. Let's start by telling us again, Rick, what's a hot dish? How's it different from a casserole?
Well, a hot dish usually has a starch, vegetable, some sort of protein, and a sauce. And Jay, feel free to chime in here, but this is kind of how Molly Ye would describe it. Plus, I've read some articles, done some research, but it's interesting because a hot dish is can be a casserole, but a casserole cannot be a hot dish because a hot dish is a main dish. A casserole is considered a side dish. And Jay, you have a little bit of a French background, but those are the differences. And it's kind of interesting when you get into those details, and people actually like to argue about that quite a bit. So,
were there any Cajun in the hot dishes you got to sample over the weekend?
No Cajun-inspired hot dishes that we had, but we had some really good ones, and some that definitely, kind of as Rick was saying, presented way more of a full meal, where you kind of got multiple components. You got the whole food pyramid in every bite. I think that's kind of what I started looking for, is if it tasted more like a side, more like you know, a green bean casserole kind of a thing, then that's not what I'm looking for. I'm looking for more of the full meal in one pan.
Tell me about crawfish. It's something I've never had. What am I missing?
So crawfish is the dish that I cooked to beat Bobby Flay on that Food Network show, on Beat Bobby Flay. I actually won that show, and so I'm a Beat Bobby Flay champion. Beat him at a crawfish boil. And so, yeah, you're missing out. Right now is the beginning of crawfish season. As long as the weather holds in South Louisiana, the crawfish start coming out of the ground, and you catch them all and you boil them a sack at a time, which is 30, 35 pounds worth of crawfish in each go. And, you know, they're little tasty baby lobsters, basically.
You eat and drink for a living. I'm guessing that is absolutely true. You got to tell us, one dish, only one dish you get to have tonight. What's it going to be?
Let's see. So Monday night I had a cookbook signing at Rosewild at the Jasper Hotel. It went really well, and I ate some great food over there. They've got that wood-fired grill. I have enjoyed this time that I've had in Fargo trying some bison. That's something that you just don't see on the menu all the time in Louisiana. I had a really nice bison filet over at 701 Eateries over the weekend as well. But that being said, if I've got one thing to eat, man, I'm a ribeye guy. I love beef. I love steak, but ribeye is my cut.
And your dessert? What's your dessert going to be?
Oh, man, there's so many good ones out there. I'm a big ice cream guy and peach cobbler. And let's see, what else do I really, really love? I pretty much eat everything sweet you put in front of me.
You had some Kuchen Sunday at the Hot Dish Festival at Brujala. Peach Kuchen.
I did. That was tasty. I enjoyed that a lot. But any kind of pie or cake or you know, just layers of fluffy dough with sugar on it, I'm always in. Beignets is a great call. Yeah, that's a good Louisiana dish. I went to Marge's Diner here. It was for breakfast, but I had their cinnamon roll French toast last weekend. That was pretty good. That could be a dessert as well.
So, Jay, reflect back on your life. How does one become an eater and a drinker for a living?
Well, I learned how to cook throwing tailgate parties for LSU football, which is what led to all the game day stuff. I grew up at hunting and fishing camps with my dad in South Louisiana and South Texas. But I got a master's degree in political science and said, well, that's not what I want to do for the rest of my life. And I fast forward a little bit, I was working a job for the state of Louisiana, sitting in a cubicle, and I started writing a blog about everything I ate and drank just to pass the time, basically. And this was in the early days of blogging and social media, 2009, 2010 timeframe. And so I was kind of early to the scene, especially in Louisiana, doing a food blog. And then that turned into radio and podcasts and TV opportunities. And the more that I kept running with it, the more that I kept enjoying it. And the blog allowed me to cook a lot more, to kind of research what foods I was cooking. I really got into watching a lot of the Food Network shows and shows from Anthony Bourdain and Andrew Zimmern and those guys on Travel Channel at the time. And I just really kind of immersed myself in it, and I became a student of food like I had been a student of political science, but this was actually something I wanted to learn about. And that came with a lot more cooking and trying things and then doing events and pop-ups. And it's really just all snowballed from there with TV opportunities and product lines and a restaurant and everything else that's come along the way.
So tell me about the Hot Dish Festival from your perspective. Jay, you come in, you take a look at this event. I'm from Wyoming, and we found that eating out here is a big deal. There's not a lot else to do in wintertime, right? So people really have a good game, in my opinion, going on with restaurants, et cetera, that are here. What's your take? What's your take on the food scene here in Fargo and in North Dakota?
Well, so the Hot Dish Festival specifically, I was very impressed by. That Brujala experience is really nice. Drecker Brewing did a great job hosting the event. The restaurants that showed up really showed up and put out some great food. There was a tremendous crowd. It was a very well-organized event. That was something to be proud of and to continue to promote. I'm glad my trip coincided with that event and that I was able to take part in that and judge that with Rick. Really, really fun there. The whole food scene in Fargo has impressed me. There's a lot of really good restaurants here. There's a lot of chefs that are really doing some cool things. There's enough of a kind of a way of looking at foodways and looking at the local food, the things that are more indigenous to here, but then mixing that with some of the trends that are happening around the country or around the world. It's really neat for me to see all of the Scandinavian and German influences, because in Louisiana we have just a touch of German influence in our sausage making, but other than that, it's really French and that Creole with a lot of African influences, and then Spanish and Italian, but you don't see much Scandinavian or a whole lot of German. So that's been really cool to see that part of the culture here.
Rick, how many hot dishes did you go through over the weekend in the Hot Dish Festival that was held at Brujala? And then get us to the winner. What was unique about the winner's dish?
Let me chime in with that, too. There were 14 hot dishes to try. So that was quite a bit of hot dish, and I actually had to bring my own spoons because the lanyard with the wooden spoon they give you, it's really a neat thing to take home, but it doesn't do the trick. It's too small. So I had to bring my own spoons, and I think the judges really appreciated that. But 14 hot dishes, some of them were very creative, some of them were very traditional. The winner was Worst Beer Hall in downtown with wild rice, tater tots, and homemade pretzels. Most creative went to Rosewild at the Jasper Hotel. They also got People's Choice. That one was really good. It was a braised pork cheek with a parsnip puree with some lingonberries, and that was quite good. And then 701 Eateries got best booth, and that was a very creative booth. So that's kind of what went on. Over 600 tickets sold. It was busy. It's just a great place. It's a fun event. It's extremely impressive, as Jay said. I've been calling it a world-class eating event for Fargo, for North Dakota. It's just a really fun event. So kudos to the folks at Brewhalla and Drecker Brewing Company.
Jay, did you agree with Rick on what he picked as the best of the good stuff and what ultimately won?
Yeah, absolutely. Looking back at my score sheet after I finished judging, I had Rosewild and then I had the Worst Beer Hall as my top two. So those were the highest scoring dishes for me. Worst ended up taking grand champion, and then Rosewild took home two prizes for People's Choice and then Most Creative from the judges. And I agree with all that. But look, there were a lot of dishes that were like right behind them, just a point off on my score sheet that I really liked as well. A pierogi style hot dish that was really tasty.
From Mezzaluna.
Yeah.
They do good work at Mezzaluna, that's for sure.
There were a lot of really good hot dishes there. It was fun to see.
And one of the hot dishes I really liked was from Nova Eatery, who's going to open up a new restaurant in downtown Fargo here, and it was the deluxe bacon chili cheese butter burger hot dish. And what I really liked is they put crushed dill potato chips on top, and it just was really good.
Jay, what's next for you? What should we keep an eye out for in your career here?
That's a great question. I'm trying to just keep everything rolling with what I have going on. And I do a fishing and cooking TV show that's based out of Louisiana. It's promoting charter fishing in Louisiana, but it's called Catch and Cook. It airs on a streaming service called Waypoint TV, which is available on all of your streaming devices, like a Roku or a Samsung Smart TV or an Apple TV. It's Waypoint TV. It's also on Mossy Oak's YouTube channel. So if you just find Mossy Oak, like the camouflage patterns of YouTube, you've got it there. And it's called Catch and Cook. It's a fun TV show that I'm doing. I've got another book that I'm working on right now. My cookbook is out now, Jay Ducote's Louisiana Outdoor Cooking. And you can find more. You can find it on Amazon and everywhere else like that. More information at jayducote.com, J-A-Y-D-U-C-O-T-E. But I've got another book that I'm working on that's more of a culinary memoir that's going to have a lot more, really kind of the details of going through my life and my career, cooking on College Game Day, beating Bobby Flay, finishing runner-up on Food Network Star, all that kind of stuff. And other than that, I do a lot of culinary travel and private chef work and cooking at food and wine festivals, so I'm always on the go somewhere new and trying to taste delicious things.
Jay Ducote's been our guest on Prairie Plates with Rick Guillon. Rick, it's awesome when you bring these guests in. I said that last week and I'll say it again. And Jay, welcome to North Dakota. We hope you had a great time in your visit.
Been a great trip. Thanks, Craig.
Thanks, Rick.
Thanks, Craig. You bet.
Rick, it was sweet. Get where I'm going with that. That you had Jay Ducote as your guest on Prairie Plates. We are here, Rick, because it is a sweet time. This is our short and sweet pledge drive. We've already had a wonderful response, and let's get right to the folks who have already supported us here at Prairie Public.
Yes, this is my favorite pledge drive of the year because you get chocolate if you call in and give us a contribution. And we've got a pile of them here. Beth from Spiritwood, North Dakota called in, so thank you, Beth. David and Kathy from Fargo. Duffy and Jane from Fargo, and Lisa from Fargo. So thank you folks for calling in. You'll be getting your box of truffles soon, I'm hoping, and please enjoy them. I know they're very, very good.
This is the way that it works. We're hoping to get 500 of these shipped anywhere in the country, and we will ship you great tasting very delicious chocolate truffles to you, to your loved one. Maybe it's your partner. Maybe it's your spouse. Maybe it's your brother or sister. Maybe it's your aunt or uncle. Maybe it's your grandparents. Maybe it's your kids. We'll ship them to you wherever they are, and they will have a handwritten note from us, and it will be in time for Valentine's Day. So how do you do all this? How do you take advantage? Well, you become a sustaining member of Prairie Public by calling us right now at 800-359-4145 or going online at prairiepublic.org. And Rick, as you said earlier, anyone who donates during this giveaway, and it is a short giveaway, I want to make that very clear because we want to get in and get out, and we hope our listeners want to make it really short for us as well. They'll be entered into a two-night stay at the Hotel Donaldson in downtown Fargo. This is a giveaway that we'll have, and also a $100 gift card to the Blarney Stone at the Hotel Donaldson. There's some good eating there, Rick.
There is. You can get a lot of traditional Irish fare like bangers and mash, corned beef and cabbage, fish and chips, Irish stew, English-style curry. The list goes on and on. But they also have good steaks, burgers, salads, wraps, all sorts of fun stuff. So call in, get your truffles, get entered today. You can stay in downtown Fargo. It's a fun place. I live in downtown Fargo. And it's just a good thing all around.
Your dollars support programs like Main Street that we have for you Monday through Thursday. And Rick, this is about North Dakota folks.
It is.
People that live here, they're our friends, they're our neighbors, and maybe they are the people that we haven't met yet, but they're here. They're not elsewhere generally, and we love having information about North Dakota that we can then pass on to our listeners. We heard about the state paleontologist earlier today. We had a wonderful event in Fargo that a nationally known celebrity, maybe?
Yeah, I'd say food celebrity.
Absolutely came in and helped us with. It's important that people contribute.
So call in today, 800-359-4145, or go to prairiepublic.org. Get those truffles. Get entered into that giveaway. You can go to Blarney Stone and get some good eats. And be sure to listen to Prairie Plates every week.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 5th. Winter in North Dakota can be challenging, but it also brings great experiences and traditions. Dakota Datebook joins the celebration of winter as we recognize Winterfest. As winter settles in, an age-old tradition breaks through the snow and ice. Ice fishing has been a popular winter pastime across the Midwest, especially North Dakota, dating back to before the territory became a state. One longtime ice fisherman described the hobby as an alien nation, a world of stinking fish slime and propane gas fumes, crystalline nights and Arctic landscapes, peppermint schnapps and beef jerky sandwiches, hopeful kids and stoic men, thundering ice and frostbitten toes, lethargic fish and ancient urges. Despite this less than appealing description, local winter and ice festivals have been celebrating the hobby for decades. A North Dakota newspaper from 1908 reported that ice fishing is a great sport these days and quite a number are at it. The fish seem to taste better at this time of the year. The joy shared in this communal activity seems to be what keeps people coming back to the ice. As the hobby grew in popularity, local papers began posting fishing regulation updates, acceptable fishing days, closed ponds, and weather conditions. Since the 1970s, advancements in clothing, boots, tech, tools, and shelters have made ice fishing more accessible to beginners and novice fishermen. A particularly popular spot for ice fishing is Devil's Lake, along with many other local spots scattered across North Dakota. Fishermen can expect to catch walleye, perch, and northern pike from these lakes. North Dakota Game and Fish provides fishing licenses, as well as updated regulations, guides, resources, and more. These resources offer access to a tradition that has been bringing families together across generations. To learn more about the history of ice fishing in North Dakota and the greater Midwest, check out the resources in the State Archives Library Collection. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Olivia Burmeister. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us.
Remember, there is still time to donate $180 one time or $15 a month during the Short and Sweet Radio Pledge Drive to receive your box of cocoa truffles and be entered into a giveaway for a two-night stay at Hotel Donaldson, and you can help us reach our 500-box goal. Go to prairiepublic.org and make someone really happy this Valentine's Day. Tomorrow on Main Street, we'll visit with Dr. Becky Phillips, an expert in ecosystem biogeochemistry with over 25 years research experience in how energy and materials cycle through the environment. As the executive director of a nonprofit in Hazleton, North Dakota, she leads pioneering research on carbon flux in rangelands, exploring how grazing management influences carbon storage. That's tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us again.